And we're going to continue with our series of reports on things that are affecting us these days. In a moment, are we on the brink of World War III? Joel Skousen joins us in a moment, and I'll tell you all about Joel when we come right back. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Joel Skousen back with us. He's the publisher of the World Affairs Brief, which is a weekly news analysis service. You can find it at worldaffairsbrief.com. He's a political scientist by training. He speaks multiple foreign languages. He's also, of course, a second career as a chief designer at the Secure Home Design Group that specializes in helping people design high-tech security residences and retreats. He's also an author, Strategic Relocation, The Secure Home, and How to Implement a High Security Shelter in the Home. Survival, Joel, and we're going to need it, I think, sooner than later. How are you?
I'm just fine, George. It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, likewise. I was just talking to Ted Koppel about hacking into the power grid. And, of course, we have been talking for years now about EMP attacks and solar flares that could take the grid down. This is something that strikes home for you, too, because you have been warning people about developing safe places to live for years now, haven't you?
That's right. I've had a worldview that indicated that our government really has some dark elements to it that are betraying what, you know, they claim are American interests and working behind the scenes, whether it's to import drugs in the name of financing black operations and fighting a war on drugs, working with terrorists of their own design to take down governments, and then fighting terrorism. I mean, this is a complex series of deceptions, and I decided early in life that this wasn't going to turn out well, and so I've decided to help other people prepare as I've been preparing.
Good. Are you convinced that we helped start and form ISIS?
I am, and I think we have the evidence to show it. I mean, there's no actual smoking gun of someone in government saying, yes, we did it, but there's an awful an awful lot of evidence that indicates that ISIS is a U.S. and British intelligence operation, and we can at least have a lot of evidence that the United States has been protecting and resupplying ISIS under many circumstances.
Is it out of control now? Have they turned on us?
Well, it's very important to understand how the U.S. and British intelligence do these things. They work through the Israeli Mossad, who has hundreds of Arab Israelis that they've turned into very effective agents that, you know, they've infiltrated the governments and the military of Iraq and Jordan and, many other countries in the Middle East. Very, very, you know, excellent agents. We don't have those kind of agents that are fluent and native Arabs
to
do that.
No, we never did.
With the Mossad to do that.
So with this creation, I mean, let's look at Iraq for just a moment. And we're going to talk about a lot of things. Turkey downing this Russian plane, and is this going to pull us into something even more extensive? But when we went into Iraq and created the weapons of mass destruction, I think George Bush was duped. I think they lied to him. His aides lied to him and tricked him and convinced him that Saddam Hussein indeed had weapons of mass destruction. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, absolutely, George. There was everyone in government was deluded by these very, very devious advisors that are at the deepest level of controlling, you know, what we consider our puppet presidents, who simply don't know what they're doing. They take orders. So they've been put into office because they're very, very compliant. Most of this happens at the National Security Council level, and that's where it's stocked with a lot of people that we call globalists. In other words, they are part of a globalist agenda. Most of them are members of the Council on Foreign Relations, a trilateral commission. In 2009, at the Munich Security Conference, it's very, very telling that General James Jones, the first national security advisor to Barack Obama, admitted after they, at the Munich Security Conference, they'd given an award to Henry Kissinger the day prior, and when he got up to give his speech, he said, you know, we have a hierarchy in the National Security Council. We get our daily marching orders from Henry Kissinger, passed down through Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger.
Exactly.
That's an admission, frankly, of conspiracy, because Henry Kissinger has no legal right to be giving suggestions, let alone daily marching orders to the National Security Council. And of course, Henry Kissinger has been known to be a globalist for many, many years.
I still think, and not that this is part of the program, that we left a lot of soldiers behind in Vietnam in those POW camps.
Absolutely, and over 15,000 American soldiers in World War II that the U.S. never forced Russia to repatriate.
Whatever happened to them?
General Jan Senyav of Czechoslovakia said that they were used for medical experiments. They went into the camps, the gulags, and they never came out. And the U.S. government knew about it. Eisenhower knew about it. I mean, this is a much bigger crime than any of the POW/MIA scandals of Vietnam. There's all the thousands. There were almost 20,000 British soldiers that were so-called liberated by the Soviets in the German Eastern camps and were never given back to the West.
Joel, I believe that I'm very patriotic. I spent 9 years in the Navy. The things I do on this program, I'm trying to do for the betterment of the country and the American people. There are a lot of people who don't like to listen to what we're hearing or what you're saying or what we have on this program. They think that we are unpatriotic because we talk about these issues. What's your take on that?
Well, how can you be patriotic and support a government that you know is taking us in a direction that's going to destroy this country and destroy its sovereignty? Now, I realize that most Americans cannot conceive that any government would be that evil to have created a 9/11 Holocaust, to have known about the Pearl Harbor attack and, in fact, fomented it and then not warned our people. I mean, it goes clear back then to the Roosevelt administration. This is something that's not new, and it's been fully documented in many, many excellent research books. And so it's just a matter, really, of not having enough exposure to the dark side of government that they are willing to stay in this aura of disbelief. But that's why I put out the World Affairs Brief. I try to give people credible information of what this, and frankly, it is a conspiracy of power. It is a conspiracy to take down national sovereignty and replace it with a global government. And I try to give credible evidence of what's going on there.
It does not mean you don't love this country.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a former military officer, a Marine pilot in the Vietnam era, and I've served my country, but frankly, I saw a lot of yes-manship in the military officer corps when I was in there, and that's one of the reasons I'm not in the military today, because, frankly, there's just an awful lot of hierarchical coming down the pike. You will do what, you know, you're told to do, and you won't object, even though you're wasting millions of dollars. Anybody who gets to a high-ranking officer in the United States military has to compromise considerably his principles to get there. And I've got the, you know, personal experience to know that that's true.
All right. Turkey recently shot down a Russian jet. One soldier died, one pilot died. The other was, I think, viciously shot down while he was parachuting. First of all, your take on the shootdown. Russia claims they were not in Turkey's airspace. Turkey claims they warned the Russian jet 10 times. Who do you believe?
Well, there's something wrong with the Turkish side of events. First of all, the small, tiny arrow tip portion of the Syrian border or Turkey-Syrian border there is only 2 miles wide. It takes approximately 6 to 9 seconds to cross that area, even if you did intrude. Recep Erdogan had said even 2 years ago that minor border incursions don't merit a military response. And yet, he went against that.
He did.
And, you know, how do you warn for 10 minutes when there's a 9-second violation? I mean, it either means you were waiting in ambush and just going through the motions of making a declaration on guard frequency, which all aircraft have, and then you shoot someone down. But frankly, my belief is, as a military pilot, that the U.S. instigated this with Turkey for a very, very specific reason.
We
have to remember that during Operation Desert Storm and in Enduring Freedom, the Russians let Iraq fall, even though they had a pact to defend it, because they figured that they could learn more by letting it fall and eavesdrop on U.S. military frequencies, electronic jamming that the U.S. aircraft use every time they go in for a bombing run. And the Russians have been devising countermeasures to our counter ECM, or electronic countermeasures, for years and developing high-tech anti-aircraft missile systems like the S-400. And the U.S. has zero intelligence on what those frequencies are, what type of jamming they're using. And I think very strongly they said, all right, we'll protect you, Turkey. You take out a Russian jet. This will force them to bring in their top-of-the-line stuff, which they haven't been doing so far. I mean, they hadn't even been using fighter escorts for these aircraft. They hadn't been using AWACS. They hadn't been using all of the stuff they've been developing. And now they are. The U.S. has forced them by doing this into bringing in the S-400, ECM jamming aircraft, air-to-air missiles. And you can bet the U.S. will be eavesdropping on every time they turn on their radar, every time they turn on their electronic jamming and figure out exactly what the Russians have.
All right, so do you think the United States just basically told the Turks, shoot down any Russian fighter?
No, not at all. All they needed to do was shoot down one in order to force the Russians to defend their airspace. And that's, I think, what's going to happen. You know, Russia, and this is one of the things, I've opposed the hype on the internet that says this is going to lead to imminent World War III. Putin made it very, very clear, we're not going to war over the downing of one aircraft. And he means it, because neither Russia and China, who are building massive weapons of mass destruction, heading for a nuclear confrontation with the West at some point, are not even close to being ready. Their top-of-the-line weapon systems aren't coming on board until 2020, 21, 22, 23, 24. So I can't imagine them being suckered into going to war too early when they haven't really built up. I mean, China and Russia need to rebuild the Blue Water Navy. It takes a Blue Water Navy to run a world war. So they're not foolish, but they are calling the U.S. bluff. The U.S., what I call, is involved in this phony war on terror, of ginning up terror so that they can justify intervening in other countries, justify taking away American liberties, justify NSA spying. War on terror just keeps this going, and they're doing this, and to a certain extent, it sets up the U.S. for a war. A world war, because we're getting the reputation of being the bully of the world around the world. I mean, people hate us, not our freedoms. They hate our U.S. intervention. And Russia and China eventually will take advantage of that, taking down the bully of the world, I believe, with the nuclear preemptive strike that they're preparing. But it's a ways off.
When you say a ways off, how far off?
I don't think we're in danger of a nuclear third world war until the beginning to the middle of next decade. And frankly, I think North Korea will be the trigger event, not the Middle East. North Korea is the perfect trigger event because, first of all, it's kind of the little wild man of Russia and China. If it takes on South Korea in a major invasion, and you have to distinguish between the minor skirmishes that North Korea always provokes every year to test their military will versus a massive invasion. You know, you got 13,000 to 20,000 U.S. combat troops in Korea. You got 50,000 South Koreans versus a 2 million man army just across the border with 20,000 artillery tubes with massive invasion tunnels. You couldn't stop a massive invasion across the North Korean border without using tactical nukes, probably. And that would hand Russia and China the excuse, I think, to initiate a nuclear preemptive strike, saying the U.S., you started it, you had first use, and we'll finish it. But there has to be a reason, George, to explain why the U.S. has treated North Korea with kid gloves versus Iran. You know, we've always been threatening to attack Iran.
We even basically permitted North Korea to develop nukes without stopping them.
And we did nothing to stop it. There's been no meaningful sanctions. Even when we did have a deal with North Korea, they broke it, and we still gave them the aid. We still gave them food. We still gave them oil. I mean, I think the globalists know that North Korea is the trigger event, and that's why they're preserving it by not taking down North Korea in the same way that they're trying to take down Iran.
And what's the bottom line here, Joel? What do they want? Do they want World War III?
Yeah, I think the globalists do, because remember, there's a tremendous backlash across the world against globalism. Look at the EU. You've got Marine Le Pen in France. You've got the UK Independent Party. Everything built. You've got Greece. You've got a major anti-EU party. In Denmark, there's a major election coming up. Major anti-EU movement in Sweden. And a lot of that due to the massive refugee flows that I think the globalists have purposely created because of this instability in the Middle East. But You see, what I'm saying is that they know that people won't voluntarily go into full global control. They resist it. They want to go back to individual sovereignty where they have some leeway, some control over their destiny. And it's just like Helmut Kohl told the Maastricht Treaty negotiators in 1997. He says, you know, the only alternative to this treaty is war. And everybody in Europe looked at each other and said, what do you mean war? There's no settlement for war. What they didn't realize is that Helmut Kohl, as a globalist, was saying, you don't go along with this stuff voluntarily. We're going to give you a war that will force you into it. And I think that's what the U.S. has been doing, you know, for 100 years, basically building up two major enemies. A lot of people don't realize the U.S. gave Russia the rest of the nuclear plans they couldn't steal from the Manhattan Project. They gave Russia the first enriched uranium so that they could explode their first nuclear weapon within a year after Hiroshima. We brought Mao Zedong to power in China by cutting off military aid to Chiang Kai-shek. We brought Castro to power by purposely cutting off aid to Batista. And we see this time and again, the globalists building enemies. And what for? These aren't suicidal people. They have an agenda, and that is to use war as the anvil to create so much conflict that it forces people to accept things that they would never normally, you know, accept.
I remember the movie W, and Richard Dreyfuss playing the part of Dick Cheney was standing at a map of the Middle East, and he points and says, this is the, they're talking about the Iraq war and going into Iraq, and he points to Iran and goes, this is the target. You believe that?
Absolutely. And what I've explained in my World Affairs brief is that Syria is not really the primary target, it's Iran. And to give you a little background here, in 2006, Israel was tasked, and we know this because there was an insider who inadvertently got invited to a globalist meeting in the city of London, where they talked about how displeased they were that Israel hadn't yet attacked Iran as she had been assigned.
And I thought they would have.
That's right. But Israel was balking because of Syria. Syria had this massive retaliatory capacity right next door. They weren't worried about Iran's retaliation if they attack their nuclear site as much as they were about ally Syria. So Israelis told the U.S., you take out Syria before we will attack Iran. And that's why the U.S., not Iran, didn't ask for the nuclear agreement. The U.S. went and invited Iran at that same time to have a nuclear agreement. Now, first of all, one thing preceded it. The U.S. was intending to take out Syria with a so-called Libyan-style no-fly zone, which, as we know, is not a no-fly zone. They had Tomahawk cruise missiles going in, they had special forces going in to destroy Gaddafi's military, so that and it was a disaster. Libya is a disaster to this day, and that's what they were going to do to to Syria. But John Kerry got before a London press conference 3 years ago, and a reporter asked him, "Hey, it's very obvious that you're going to do an attack on Syria. Is there anything that they can do to stop this?" And John Kerry, just off the top of his head, said, oh, yeah, they could just give up their chemical weapons and we wouldn't attack. And wham, Syria says, we accept.
And then they didn't know what to do. Joel, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk more about this world events on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Joel Skousen with us. Joel, when Russia got involved in protecting the Assad regime in Syria, did that throw a monkey wrench into the plans to get him out?
Yes, it absolutely did, and in fact, I was surprised it took Russia so long to figure out how easy it would be to thwart this globalist agenda. Before the break, I was talking about what the globalist agenda is vis-a-vis Iran. The reason that Iran is targeted for destruction, and thus Syria, because it's an ally and the greatest threat for retaliation to Israel if Israel should start this war with Iran. Iran is the only Muslim country that's trying to become self-sufficient in the full range of weapon systems. Every other Arab and Muslim country is basically linked to the West, mostly now, for their arms, and they can be cut off at any time, like Iran was. It had F-14 Tomcats from the U.S., and then the U.S. cut off the parts supply, and those airplanes weren't flying within 2 months.
During the Shah administration.
That's right. And so Iran decided, hey, we're not going to be beholden to east or west. We're going to build our own weapons, including nuclear weapons. And the U.S. And the various globalists decided, no, we want all the Arab and Muslim countries to be cannon fodder, so to speak, in wars. They were in World War One, and we'll break all our promise to them, but we'll keep them under a noose of controlling their weapons. And Iran's trying to break that. And so when Israel balked at starting a war with Iran, remember, U.S. was keeping three carrier groups offshore Iran for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years, threatening Iran with destruction as soon as Israel would start it. But Israel balked until Syria was taken out of the way, and that was going apace. U.S. was going to attack Syria 3 years ago until this disastrous news conference happened, and Kerry offered them an out. Syria took it, and suddenly the globalists had their agenda stymied. And what they did is immediately offer a nuclear agreement with Iran as an excuse to explain why the U.S. was stepping down from not attacking Iran, and the carrier groups went home. They had to have a plausible excuse, and the excuse, well, we're negotiating for a nuclear deal. But what was interesting about that is that the U.S. made the offer, and the U.S. kept lying about what the Iranians had agreed to. And there were three major steps to this nuke agreement. At each step, the U.S. would come out after the negotiations and say, hey, Iran agreed to do this and this and this, and Iran said, no, we didn't. You said we didn't have to give up any centrifuges. We didn't have to give up any uranium. And the U.S. said, oh, yes, you did. Well, the Iranians were tape recording this stuff. They came out and proved that the U.S. was lying. But at each stage, the U.S. knew the Iranians were so desperate to get rid of these sanctions, which were really hurting the country after confiscating all their bank accounts. They kept being lured into this agreement. The U.S. would lure them in with easy terms and then change the terms during negotiations. In fact, they began, and a lot of Americans don't know this, to even include conventional disarmament provisions in the last version of the so-called nuclear agreement. And then the big thing we find out just this last month is that Iran never signed the agreement, and neither did the U.S. But the U.S. is playing as if this agreement is in full force, and in fact, there are no signatures on it, according to the congressmen who are holding hearings about the agreement. But basically what this nuke agreement is, George, is a trap set for Iran. So when the U.S. gets Syria out of the way and can sick Israel back on the attack mode...
And that will happen eventually.
It will happen eventually, and the U.S. will use this nuclear agreement, even though it hasn't been signed, as the trap to say, you violated this, they put so many provisions, and they know that Iran will violate some of those. And they've got an automatic provision in this that has become part of a UN Security Council resolution that automatically gives UN authorization to attack Iran if there's any violation of this agreement. So this is just a trap waiting to happen as soon as Syria is out of the way. And Russia, by intervening in the Syrian, saving Syria from being taken down, has stopped this agenda, because Israel won't attack until Syria is taken down, and I think Russia is going to stop that from happening.
Let me tell you what concerns me and what I find to be very strange. You know, the pictures, the videos we saw of ISIS members in Humvees and brand-new trucks and waving their flag along a huge corridor line in Iraq, and not one jet or helicopter took them out. I found that to be the strangest video, especially with satellite technology. I mean, there's no way they could just show up for 2 miles long in Iraq and satellites not see them. Something was wrong there, Joel, and I never was able to put my finger on it.
Well, there's also, you know, a video of that line of 100 Toyota, brand-new, identical Toyota Hilux trucks, which came from U.S. inventories, by the way. The U.S. has admitted that they gave them to the moderates, and somehow they got into the hands of ISIS. Well, actually, they went directly to ISIS. Nobody gets 100 identical Toyota Hilux trucks unless they go through a government. But in any case, there was an Apache helicopter flying overhead that convoy as well and not attacking it, just accompanying it as if it were guarding it. Now, this matches the other evidence that I've had, which I'll briefly go through, about the U.S. protecting ISIS. First of all, when the big attack in Iraq started from ISIS, out of nowhere, you know, you have this 50,000, 60,000 people ISIS attack, and nobody knew about it? I mean, how believable is that? In fact, the Iraqi government had been crying out to the U.S. government saying, hey, they've got these big weapons depots being formed out in the desert. We need you to blow these up, and the U.S. refused. Then during the attack on Mosul, for example, the Iraqis filmed U.S. helicopters resupplying ISIS behind the lines. And they also noted that after the conquering of Mosul, ISIS had a huge victory parade down the major highway with all of their tanks and their Humvees and all this so-called stolen U.S. equipment, and the U.S. never attacked it.
Never attacked.
Same thing as the Toyota trucks and things.
Wait, and don't you find that bizarre?
Well, except for the revelation that the U.S. created ISIS, and therefore this is their terrorist organization, they're only feigning attack. Look, I'm a Navy pilot flying for the Marine Corps. I know what happens when you go out there and you try to get permission to attack a target. And Navy pilots continually say, we can't get permission. We're flying around there. We see a major tank, a major convoy, and we radio for permission to attack, and it doesn't come, and it doesn't come. And finally, an hour later, it comes, and we're bingo fuel. That means we got to return to base. And so we can't attack. It happens time after time. Navy pilots are just mad as hell, George, because it appears that, you know, they just can't get the job done. We're also finding out now that the U.S. is dropping leaflets and warning ISIS people when there's an attack, supposedly to stop civilian casualties. But the buildings we see them attacking with smart weapons are empty. The camps that we see them attacking are empty because they've been warned in advance. So the U.S. is carrying out 7,000 strikes in the past year, but very little to show for it. And I think there's a reason, because ISIS is a U.S. creation in order to get an excuse to get back into Syria after that chemical weapons agreement stopped the U.S. from taking down Syria. Now they've got an excuse, and ISIS was that. Now we find out there's tons of evidence of Turkey as a U.S. ally doing most of the marketing of all the oil coming out of ISIS. And I asked in the World Affairs Brief years ago, I said, when it says ISIS is the wealthiest and they're using oil stolen from Syria tomorrow, I said, how do you do that? I mean, all the oil has to go through major terminals.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to have a plan in place. You don't steal oil.
Dime, you know. And sure enough, we find out now that Bilal Erdogan, the son of the president of Turkey, runs one of the major transportation shipping companies of oil, and he's marketing ISIS oil throughout the world. And
why can't we target that? Why shouldn't we target that?
Yeah, you know, and at the G20 meeting, Putin showed satellite photos of these convoys of oil trucks lining up at the Turkish border and said, hey, U.S., you're supposed to be fighting ISIS. Why aren't you targeting this? The next day, the U.S. targeted one of those convoys. But they've been doing this for a year, George. And the U.S. did nothing until Putin embarrassed them at the G20 meeting and pointed out the U.S. has satellite photos of these things and they're not attacking these things.
Then explain that. If we created ISIS, if we continue to support them in some form or fashion, what happened in Paris? Because I don't think, would we have wanted ISIS to attack in Paris?
Yes, I think there's a real reason for that. One, remember that 9/11, which I believe, and I'll be very frank, even on the air, was a government operation from beginning to end, including the hiring of the terrorists.
So you say government operation, I say insiders knew about it and let it happen.
Well, you know, there's various degrees of what it is, but I've got sufficient evidence to say that only the government could have pulled this off. It's not about knowing about it and letting it happen. I mean, look, there were tons of explosives put in all three World Trade buildings, the Trade Center buildings that came down, and only government had access to do that. You look at the airplane that crashed in the Pentagon was laced with explosives. It's not just a bomb in a cargo compartment.
Well, and some say a plane never even hit the Pentagon.
Well, but that's because, you know, the one credible witness that said the plane hit the wall, crumpled up, and the wall held up like a champ, and then it exploded, and it went into confetti-sized pieces all over the parking lot. That had to be not just a bomb in the cargo compartment, which would have left major pieces of the aircraft out there on the lawn. Yeah. It had to be that aircraft was laced with explosives, which no terrorist could have done had access to that aircraft.
And maybe even in the nose cone.
That's right, because the nose cone was intact inside the Pentagon, or at least half of it. And that could have only happened if there were a hole in that wall before the airplane hit. Otherwise, fiberglass nose cone hitting a reinforced concrete wall would have been.
Okay, so back to Paris, though. Yeah. What happened?
So here's the suspicion that we have. First of all, 9/11 was the U.S. excuse to go rampaging through the world, but Europe wasn't involved. Basically, say, this is the U.S. problem. We'll let the U.S. run all these terror operations. And so the U.S., I think, or British, U.S., French intelligence, whoever put all this together, decided we need to get Europe on board with all this terror, and that's exactly what the Paris attacks did. All of a sudden, France starts attacking, Germany's starting to send planes in, Britain is trying to get in on the war on terror as well. But the two signs that I viewed from the attack that showed that this was a government operation and not a jihadist ISIS operation are two. One, none of the suicide bombers were religious. Typical bar-hopping, porno types, you know.
Wild people.
Just like the list of 9/11 hijackers in the bars and stuff. These
they went to strip places before attack, didn't they?
That's right. And number two, and this the media refused to cover, I'm just incredulous, except one newspaper out of Britain said witnesses, and they quoted witnesses from the mobile, this attack team that went from restaurant to bar in Paris, shooting, it was a black Mercedes. Remember, they talked about looking for the Volkswagen Passat that some terrorists used, but nobody mentioned the black Mercedes the witnesses said came up to the restaurants and bars, and they were white. They were not Muslim. They were hitmen, professionals, going and mowing down people calmly.
What was the motive?
Well, the motive, I think, was to get Europe involved in the war on terror. The downside of this was that it really ginned up the anti-refugee movement in Europe and had forced these governments to stop accepting a lot of refugees.
Well, this is where I'm confused. If we created 9/11, if we created ISIS, then what's the war on terror against?
The war on terror is against national sovereignty. The war on terror is against civil rights. It's to justify NSA spying. And look what happened in France. All of a sudden, you had an emergency measure that allowed people to be arrested without warrants, to be spied on unlimited, and that's still in vogue today in Europe. So you see, terrorism justifies the diminution of essential civil rights and liberties.
Are we attacking the same people we created?
Not really. They do take down some people because they're disposable. But a lot of the other, like these operatives in the Mercedes, they got away scot-free. Nobody even has them on the list of what they're looking for. That's got to tell you something. In other words, we're protecting the professionals we hired, but there's a few of these people we hire. And some terrorists do get killed in some of these strikes. You have to remember that when you run a terrorist organization, the terrorists themselves don't know this. They just know that an Arab-looking guy is our leader. He's got the money. He's got the plans. He's got access to the funds that keep us going, and we just follow orders. But the basic terrorists don't know that they're disposable, and they don't know that the operation at the higher level is being run by U.S. and British.
So they're being used.
Yeah.
These.
So some of them are disposed of, but these hitmen were never even looked for, and that Mercedes is not on the list of vehicles the government in France is looking
for. Well, these are the things that I find to be unusual. They've taken over oil wells and nobody stops them.
Right.
They sell the oil. Nobody stops them. They get weapons. Nobody stops them. They seem to go and come and go wherever they want. Nobody seems to stop them. These are all, to me, very bizarre situations. The caravan of trucks, nobody took them out. Nobody stopped them. So there is, I will admit, Joel, there is something very weird going on about this. I mean, this is just not conventional warfare as far as I'm concerned. I mean, in World War II, had the Nazis did exactly what ISIS is doing, we would have taken out their oil refineries, their transport systems, their columns of troops. We wouldn't have stopped.
And that's exactly what we did in World War II. But we aren't doing it with ISIS. Until the Russians have embarrassed the U.S. and they've had to do something, they've made one or two bombing, but the Russians are taking out most of the oil trucks. And the U.S. warned the drivers beforehand to flee. They didn't want to kill anybody who was working for ISIS.
Is Russia making a dent in ISIS?
They are a significant dent, but the mainstream media is, and the U.S. is complaining about U.S. targeting or Russia targeting U.S.-backed rebels, and they are doing that because, first and foremost...
But U.S.-backed rebels are ISIS, according to you, right?
No. They are different. Let me tell you how this happens.
See how confusing it is for everybody?
And it is very complex, though. I mean, this is not simple. What the U.S. did about 2.5-3 years ago when they created ISIS is go in to the jihadists that they were supplying and said, all right, half of you guys are now going to be ISIS. Now, they didn't actually tell them all that in a big meeting. They basically sent in, I believe, Arab-Israeli agents who were trained to lead these people come in and said, all right, we're the new leaders here. You guys are going to, we're going to call ourselves ISIS. We're going to start this caliphate.
We're going to cut off heads. We're going to put it on video.
That's right. And, you know, look at that. If you're going to start a Muslim world and take over the world, you're not going to try to antagonize everybody, including fellow Muslims. And that's what these terrorists, these staged terrorist videos did. They did nothing but create hatred. They create a monster. And that shows that the purpose of this was to gin up horror in the minds of people so that they would abide by anything government said you've got to do to get rid of ISIS. But ISIS was this U.S. creation, and but there are different versions. Now, I don't believe there are any moderates out there among the rebels in Syria. They're all various forms of jihadists. But they did take probably the worst of the worst and put them into ISIS, and they called them. I mean, they created a new organization called the Syrian Democratic Army just 2 weeks ago. That shows how they do this. They just changed the name. And the reason they did that is because they're trying to do a political solution to get rid of Assad. And so you got to have democratic forces to sit at the table opposing Assad. And they just called these rebels, you're now...
Yeah, Assad's out. As far as I'm concerned, he's out. If he were smart, he'd work on his exit plan right now, don't you think?
Well, you got to remember... Assad has been given a bad rap. This is a very mild-mannered, sane medical doctor, Western-trained. This is not like his father.
Whose brother was supposed to be running the country.
That's right.
And he died. Stay with us, Joel. We're at the top of the hour. We'll talk more in Fast Night. We'll also take phone calls about this truly bizarre situation.